Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, February 8th. I'm asking you to please have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down the names, addresses, emails, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. And let's start with announcements. The California Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Team is having a restoration this Saturday, February 10th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. They'll be going back to the sandhills of Quail Hollow Ranch and continuing their broom bash efforts, removing invasive non-native French broom. To get to Quail Hollow, take Graham Hill Road up from Santa Cruz. As you come down the hill into Felton, turn right at the light and drive 2 miles up East Ziandi Road, and then turn left on Quail Hollow Road, and the park entrance is a half mile up on the right-hand side of the road. They'll meet you in the gravel parking lot at the left side of the entrance. They're a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County, and their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. It will be sunny this weekend, but if things get particularly unpleasant up there, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided. Please bring your gloves and something to drink. If you want further information, you can go to their website, www.cruzcnps.org. That's cruzcnps.org. And save next week for the buffalo. Mark your calendars and plan to join the Buffalo Field Campaign for some winter rallies for wild buffalo. Starting February 12th, they'll be meeting in and around Yellowstone National Park. So go to the webpage at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org to look up where they'll be on what day. That's www.buffalofieldcampaign.org, their week of action, February 12th through the 18th. And unfortunately, John Perry Barlow has died in his sleep. In Wyoming at the age of 70, he was a poet, an essayist, a Wyoming rancher, and a wilderness buff, and a founder of the internet. He was also one of the Grateful Dead's principal lyricists, and he was also the founder of both the Electronic Frontier Foundation as well as the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He headed the Wyoming Outdoor Council for some time and was an ardent environmentalist and often identified as an anarchist. John Perry Barlow, dead at the age of 70. And nearly 4 eco-defenders were killed per week in 2017 amid a ruthless scramble for resources. Until companies, investors, and governments genuinely include communities in their decisions around the use of land and natural resources, the people who dare to speak out will continue to face violence, imprisonment, and loss of life. In this story by Julia Conley, staff writer for Common Dreams. Nearly 4 people per week were killed in 2017 while defending their land and the environment from what environmental and human rights groups call Global Witness calls the ruthless scramble for natural wealth. A new analysis by the group counted 197 victims of the quest by miners, poachers, and agribusiness to take control of land around the world in order to sell natural resources, but believes many more deaths were likely to have gone unreported. Agribusiness took over mining as the industry linked to the most killings, according to the report, as well as the demand for soybeans, meat, sugarcane, palm oil, and other agriculture around the world. Latin America saw the most eco-defenders killed last year, with 46 people killed in Brazil, 32 in Colombia. In September, 6 farmers were killed in Peru by a criminal gang that tried to seize their land for use in the palm oil trade. Other notable examples of deadly fights over resources include the deaths of a Turkish couple who were shot to death in their home after winning a legal battle over the extraction of marble from a quarry, and an Indian family that was killed for protesting the use of sand from a riverbank in their village, sought by developers who wanted to use it for concrete. In its report, Global Witness stressed the importance of accounting for the deaths of every environmental defender. While the number of killings in 2017 is four times that which was first recorded by the group in 2002, eco-defenders' deaths have leveled off for the first time in 4 years. As the international community sits up and listens to these hidden stories and momentum for renewed pressure on companies and investors to take more responsibility and further scrutinize governments who have allowed those who kill to get away with it, wrote Cox. By putting these killings on the map and campaigning for governments, companies, and investors to safeguard and consult communities affected by projects on their land, we hope that our work helps to end levels of impunity that have emboldened the perpetrators of violence and, in most cases, allowed them to literally get away with murder. Environmental groups are suing to block a road through an Alaskan refuge in this story from the Washington Post, written by Dan Joling. 9 environmental groups sued the U.S. government Wednesday to block a land trade that could lead to construction of a road through a national wildlife refuge in Alaska that is habitat for migrating waterfowl. The group sued Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, who had signed an agreement last week to swap land in the Isambeck National Wildlife Refuge for private land held by an Alaska Native Village Corporation. The village of King Cove wants a road through the Isambeck for land access to the nearby community of Cold Bay, home to an all-weather airport. The road would slice through a length of a narrow isthmus separating lagoons used by hundreds of thousands of waterfowl. The groups contend that Zinke lacks the authority to swap land within a refuge established by Congress. Secretary Zinke has violated his most sacred responsibility to the American people. Fran Maurer, a retired U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wildlife biologist and Alaska representative of Wilderness Watch, said in an announcement of the lawsuit filed in Anchorage. Exhaustive studies have shown that a road through the Isambeck Wilderness would severely impact wildlife and destroy the wilderness character of one of our nation's most diverse and biological productive national wildlife refuges, Maurer said. Heather Swift, a spokeswoman for Zinke, referred a request for comment to the U.S. Department of Justice, which said it's reviewing the lawsuit and had no further comment. When Zinke signed the land trade agreement last week, he said the 12-mile section of road through the refuge would cause no harm to wildlife, but would make a difference to children and mothers who needed to get to a hospital. He said the road was a priority for President Donald Trump. Residents of King Cove, with a population of more than 900, have sought access for decades to Cold Bay with the all-weather airport. King Cove is wedged between mountains and the ocean at the end of the Alaska Peninsula, and flights are often canceled because of high wind or other foul weather. Backers of the road say commercial traffic would be banned on the one-lane gravel road. Congress in 1997 addressed King Cove transportation by providing $37.5 million for water access to Cold Bay that included a $9 million hovercraft. The regional governing body took the vessel out of service after deciding it was too expensive and unreliable to operate. In establishing the refuge, the Interior Department called it the most important concentration point for waterfowl in Alaska. Katie Strong, an attorney for Trustees of Alaska, the environmental law firm representing the group, said Congress passed the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act to preserve national landscapes, wildlife, and unaltered ecosystems. It also designated wilderness areas, including Isambeck. The lawsuit says Zinke improperly used a provision of the law for the land swap. If allowed to stand, this would be the first time that a wilderness is taken away from the American public with the stroke of a single person's pen, Strong said. It is short-sighted, unlawful, and contrary to the careful deal struck in the Alaskan conservation law. And young Colombians have filed a lawsuit against the government over deforestation. In this story by Anastasia Maloney of the Thomas Reuters Foundation News, as found on the Earth First Newswire. A group of young Colombians, one as young as 7, filed a lawsuit against the Colombian government on Monday, demanding it protect their right to a healthy environment in what campaigners said was the first such action in Latin America. The lawsuit filed at a Bogota court alleges the government's failure to stem rising deforestation in Colombia puts their future in jeopardy and violates their constitutional rights to a healthy environment, life, food, and water. Deforestation is threatening the fundamental rights of those of us who are young today and will face the impacts of climate change the rest of our lives, the 25 plaintiffs, whose ages range from 7 to 26, said in a joint statement. We are at a critical moment given the speed at which deforestation is happening in the Colombian Amazon. The government's lack of capacity and planning, as well as its failure to protect the environment, makes the adoption of current measures necessary. It is the first climate change legislation in Latin America, according to the Bogota-based rights group, which is supporting the plaintiff's case. The lawsuit follows recent surge in litigation around the world demanding an action or claiming damages over the impact of climate change, from rising sea levels to pollution. And Hong Kong has banned all local ivory sales in this story written by Noel Kirkpatrick of Mother Nature Network. Hong Kong voted to shut down the ivory trade in the city a week ago. Wednesday, the ban will go in effect by 2021. Lawmakers voted 49-4 to amend an existing law to outlaw ivory sales in the Chinese-ruled city, enacting a fine of 10 million Hong Kong dollars, about $1.3 million United States, double the current amount, and increasing the prison term from 2 years to 10 years. China officially banned ivory sales in December 31st of 2017 and shut down carving shops and factories last March, but the ban didn't apply to Hong Kong. Hong Kong is widely considered the world's largest retail ivory market, according to the Associated Press, even though existing Hong Kong law followed regulations under the Convention for the International Trade of Endangered Species and Wild Fauna and Flora, or CITES. Under CITES, ivory trading was regulated in 1975, with a total ban on international sales going into effect in 1990. Activists have contended that many Hong Kong dealers exploited this loophole by selling newer ivory as if it were pre-CITES ivory, forging pre-convention certificates, and selling the new ivory as antiques. Under the new legislation, importing and re-exporting ivory from the city will be prohibited regardless of when the ivory was collected. The new law's implementation period is intended to give current ivory traders time to find new work. It was suggested that the government buy the ivory stock from current traders or at least compensate traders in some way. To expect ivory traders in their 60s to change industries is impractical, one lawmaker Peter Hsu said Wednesday, as reported in the New York Times. Do you expect them to take online courses? This course of action was not adopted by lawmakers, with many pointing out that traders have plenty of time to find new lines of work since ivory trade has essentially been banned for 3 decades, and that they still have another 3 years to find new employment. Providing any form of compensation will signal that Hong Kong is buying ivory, which will likely cause a surge in poaching. And the Ivory Coast in Africa seizes a huge haul of elephant tusks and pangolin scales in this story from Reuters. As around 600 kilograms of ivory tusks and 600 kilograms of pangolin scales have been seized in Ivory Coast, ready to be sent to Vietnam and other Asian countries, authorities said. In an operation lasting several days that aimed to dismantle a major trafficking network, 6 suspects were arrested. The ivory was ready for export to Vietnam. The pangolin scales were destined for Asia, Bonaventure Adomo, head of Ivory Coast's anti-smuggling unit, told reporters. The unit said 2 of the suspects came from Ivory Coast and 1 from Guinea, and that the ivory had come from as far afield as Gabon, Nigeria, Mozambique, and Uganda. The anti-trafficking group Eagle, which worked with the authorities, said 2 of the suspects were from Vietnam and 1 from China. The tusks were valued at $450,000 and the pangolin scales at $350,000 on the black market, authorities said. The pangolin, a small armadillo-like animal, lives in the forests of Ivory Coast and elsewhere in Western Africa. Global trade in them is banned under a UN convention, but their scales are prized in some Asian countries for use in traditional medicines. And a lead ivory trade investigator has been found dead in Kenya in this story from Reuters. A prominent American investigator of illegal ivory and rhino horn trade has been found dead in his Nairobi home with a stab wound to his neck, media reported. Esmond Bradley Martin, 75, had spent decades tracking the movement of animal products, mostly from Africa to markets in Asia. It's a very big loss for conservation, said Paula Kahumbu, chief executive of Wildlife Direct, an organization focused on protecting elephants in Kenya. He had been about to publish a report exposing how the ivory trade had shifted from China to neighboring countries, Kahumbu added. A former UN special envoy for rhino conservation was found in his home on Sunday afternoon, friends said. Bradley Martin's research was instrumental in China's decision to ban its legal rhino horn trade in 1993, and it also pressured China to end the legal ivory sales, a ban which came into force on January 1st. His work revealed the scale of the problem and made it impossible for the Chinese government to ignore, said Kahumbu. He was an expert on the prices of ivory and rhino horn, leading undercover investigations into markets in China and Southeast Asia. He is the second prominent conservationist to die in East Africa in the past year. South African Wayne Lotter, whose work targeted ivory smuggling from Africa to Asia, was shot dead in Tanzania in August. There was no immediate comment from the police. And also from Reuters, president of a Thai construction firm has been charged with poaching. The president of Italian Thai Development PCL, Thailand's largest construction company, and three others were charged with poaching and trespassing in a wildlife sanctuary, police said on Tuesday. Premchai Karnasutta, president of the construction firm, and three others were arrested at the Thungyai Nariswan Wildlife Sanctuary in Thailand's western Kanchanaburi province on Sunday, according to the Department of National Parks, Wildlife, and Plants Conservation. The four have denied the accusations. The deputy spokesperson of the Royal Thai Police, Krisana Padakarayon, said. Italian Thai Development did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Reuters could not immediately make contact with Premchai's lawyer to seek comment either. Poaching carries a maximum jail sentence of 5 years in Thailand. The company's share price fell 3.6% on a broader market that fell 1.2%. And from the Buffalo Field Campaign, this is the update from the field. She was a powerful leader from the imperiled central herd, a direct descendant from the original 23 survivors, her ancestors who saved themselves from the U.S. government's attempted genocide during the 19th century, when nearly 60 million buffalo used to roam the continent. She gained her immense wisdom by being taught by her own mother and grandmother as they in turn learned from theirs and on down the family lineage since buffalo time began. Like the mothers before her, she taught the young ones where to find the best water, where to give birth, where to find the best grasses and sedges, how to escape the deepest snow, how to stick together to stay safe from predators, and indeed, how to flee to the thick forest to escape helicopters, horse riders, ATV, and law enforcement during hazing season. Years ago, she had been captured and violated by Yellowstone biologists who placed a thick leather radio collar around her neck to keep track of her movements. They labeled her S3. We loathe these collars and what they represent for any wildlife, partly because they are highly visible and recognizable. As much time as we spend with the buffalo, we know how many individuals, by the shape of their horns, the color of their fur, their scars, nicks, hairdos, but those collars, tools of the panopticon, are worn by a few unlucky adult females, and they make undeniable identifiers. These collars, we have been told, are supposed to fall off after a few years, but we've seen no evidence of this, as many of the females who were forced to wear them have been wearing them for close to a decade. S3 was no exception. We have known her for many years. In the most recent times, we had seen her in the Hebgen Basin coming to her spring calving grounds again this winter. She arrived with her large extended family in the company of a couple other colored females, including A3, K4, and one who had a collar with no identifying marks. When she and her family arrived, so did scores of hunters. Some of her friends and relatives were killed by hunters, and she took the survivors away to safety. On three different occasions, this kind of scene played out. She and her herd would arrive, hunters would follow, make as many kills as they could, and she would leave once again, bringing her family back to where she knew they were safe. She was also the one who surprised us by taking an unusual route, not along the bluffs of the Madison River, but through the thick woods to the north, seeking shelter and a quick departure through the trees. One day, after leaving this way for a second time, she pleasantly shocked us while we were checking on some bachelor buffalo. She had led her people far north of where the family groups tend to migrate, and we found her and over 100 others in the company of some these bulls, something most of us never had seen before and others hadn't seen for nearly 12 years. Again, she and her family returned, and again the hunters came, and again she led her people to safety. Then, long after that, 2 weeks ago, our gardener patrol spotted her in the Gardner Basin all the way to the north. She was living proof that central herd buffalo migrate into both basins, suffering tragic consequences. She was with a herd of about 80 buffalo on a school football field with no less than 5 of the young bulls who escaped quarantine last month. It was so amazing to ponder her journey, the decisions she made, and why. Last weekend, she came back to the west side to the Hebgen Basin, sadly, for the last time. A hunting party had found her, and they took her life. Our patrols, while confronting the hunters, asked if they had shot a male or female. They said they didn't know, but it had this collar thing on. When we asked what the collar said, one person in the group said it looked like 53. We were crushed. We knew then that not only had S3 returned one more time, but it was her that the hunters had killed. We don't know why her sex. They didn't know her sex before they killed her. They didn't consider that it might be unwise to shoot a collared buffalo, never mind the dangers of killing any female from the central herd. But even after field dressing her, they didn't even know she was a female. The following morning, our patrols found a calf in her womb, left there in the gut pile. And you can find more information at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. 34 Andean condors have been found dead in Argentina, and poisoning is suspected in this story from Reuters. An unprecedented number of Andean condors were found dead in western Argentina this week, threatening a symbolic bird whose numbers are dwindling in parts of South America. The bodies of 34 condors, 20 males and 14 females, were reported to environmental authorities in Mendoza province, and toxicology tests suggested that they had been poisoned, the province said in a statement. Luis Hocom, director of the Andean Condor Conservation Project in Buenos Aires, said the condor deaths from eating poisoned carcasses have become more common as a result of what authorities suspect is an effort to kill predators of cattle. This is reflecting the bad practices of ranchers in terms of toxic bait, he said in an interview on Thursday. Sheep, goats, and a puma were also found dead on Monday in the same area near the town of Los Molles. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature considers the Andean condor a nearly threatened species, estimating South America has around 10,000 of the birds. They are more common in southern South America and are now very rare in Ecuador and Venezuela. Vanessa Estor, executive director of the Condor Conservation Project, said condors take a long time to mature and are slow to breed, making the poisoning of adults particularly devastating. One of the largest flying birds in the world, condors can live for 70 years. This really puts conservationists on alert, she said. It could lead to the extinction of the species. And is this the year the Florida grasshopper sparrow goes extinct in this story from The Revelator? This year, the United States could experience its first bird extinction in more than 3 decades. That's the warning from scientists and conservationists working to protect the critically endangered Florida grasshopper sparrow. Once again, in the grasslands of central Florida, this geographically isolated subspecies has experienced a catastrophic population decline since the 1970s, mostly due to habitat loss and degradation. Although the tiny birds have been protected by the Endangered Species Act since 1986, their numbers have continued to fall to the point where recovery now seems next to impossible. A survey last year found that just 22 females and 53 males remained in the wild, and that was before 2017's hurricane season and record-setting winter cold snaps. Extinctions really happen, warns Paul Rayo, zoologist and president of the Rare Species Conservation Foundation in Loxahatchee, Florida. This is going to be North America's next extinct bird if we do nothing. Rayo said just one option left to save the Florida grasshopper sparrow, the captive breeding program that began in 2015. Captive breeding is never anyone's desire, and it's always the approach of last resort, he said. Given the collapse of the wild population, it's not only the last option, it's the last of the last option. Getting to this point took several years of debate among various government agencies and partner organizations working to protect the birds. Finally, the first sparrow eggs and juvenile birds were brought into captivity at the Rare Species Conservatory and the White Oak Conservation Center plantation near Jacksonville in 2015 and 2016, respectively. As with any captive breeding program, learning how to get the birds to mate and hatch outside their native habitat has been a complex process. Early attempts to hatch the birds' tiny eggs failed before the team established the proper temperature, humidity, and incubator rotation procedures. They learned quickly, though. By May 2016, a successful artificial incubation protocol had been established. The first captive-laid eggs hatched that month at the conservatory. Several additional chicks have now been born since that point, although not all have survived. The captive population now stands at a total of 48 birds, with 29 living at the conservatory in Loxahatchee. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can hear a rebroadcast tomorrow, that's Friday at 3 p.m. as part of our Environment Friday programming. You could also listen to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Friday at 5:30 in the morning, KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m., KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m., and WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. You can also hear the Earth First Update on KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill and Gilroy, California, KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California, KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, and Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 in Berkeley, California. You can tune in online at the Grateful Dread Public Radio, online at gdprrevolution.com, that's gdprrevolution.com, Sundays at 2 a.m. Central Time. Or you can always go to radio4all.net, that's radio, the number 4all.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous Earth First updates anytime you want to. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio, produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz by yours truly, Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.